horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. I didn't hear anything for a second, Case, and I thought, wait a minute, what's good? Is that I quickly look at my equipment. I'm thinking, I think I got cut off, but no, it was okay. Oh, computer froze up. That's the worst. Second half on this Thursday, and Steve Askin swings in wake of Secretariat Fest. How was that,
Steve? I have no clue. I was in Connecticut and Vermont. I watched stuff after the fact, which looked very good.
Nice.
The virtual tour of old friends looked good. Claiborne looked good. So I had to watch it. Had to watch it after the fact. But I heard it went well.
Cool. Well, we featured it. We featured it in part of the conversation. I didn't want to let it slip through the cracks. So that's nice that you had a chance to spend some time with the baby.
Yes, actually, we were in Brattleboro, Vermont, and I didn't see the same foliage you did when you were in Vermont because
really
all the leaves were gone on my side of Vermont.
Huh. All the leaves were
everything
are brown and the sky is gray.
Many trees were bare. Driving up 91 was totally green. I thought it was all the foliage. There was like pockets of foliage going up, but there was nothing. We went on a hike and we were like trampling our way through 6 tons of leaves that had already fallen.
That's really funny. I suppose that part of that could be that, you know, the wind patterns and so forth, you know, on either side of the mountain range, but it's been gorgeous here. I mean, you wouldn't have believed what was going on the western end of Vermont. And
I don't know. It's kind of weird. I mean,
that is.
They said they had a big windstorm and that sort of blew a lot of the
leaves
off. Yeah,
must have. Yep.
But, you know, I was going up there expecting to see the usual spectacular Vermont foliage. It was supposed to peak last weekend, and we got up there. And then before we got up there, my sister-in-law said a lot of the leaves are gone already. They just got blown off.
Well, it's too bad.
But I thought 91 was going to be spectacular going up, you know, there. And I'm saying, this looks like July. Looks like my backyard.
That's really strange. Here it's well then you should have commandeered the Friedberg's place and come over here.
Well, we were invited, but we had our priorities. This time it was going up to visit my sister-in-law in Brattleboro.
Nice.
We made scarecrows for a at an event in Brattleboro where people make their own scarecrows and they post them, and I guess they'll be judged. So we made a really crazy looking scarecrow from all the stuff around the house, and took a nice hike in the woods. And it was very nice. I had a picnic, very very Vermont-y fall afternoon, except for the foliage.
Tina and I will venture over the mountain. I talked about this maybe 3 weeks ago when we went, give or take. We'll go to Brattleboro for lunch. to the Vermont Country Store. They've got fabulous.
The Vermont Country Store is an awesome place.
Yeah, the pork, the maple pork barbecue.
We went to a it was sort of a bourbon or whiskey tasting place that used to be right on the river, and they moved. And, you know, you can get regular soft drinks, but you can get, tastings of different kinds of whiskey. There's bourbon and then maple this and maple that and all kinds of liqueurs. So we went there, and And you go in the parking lot, by the way. I think our car was like the only car with a Vermont license plate. I mean, people just coming from everywhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah, last week, this past week, and when we were in Manchester and Dorset and Bennington, and then there was just, you know, you had the leaf-peeping crowd was all over the place. Well, Steve, I'm going to put up a picture that Skip Dickstein's listening, and he just sent a picture from Jim Bond's farm, and it's gorgeous. It looks like a postcard.
That's kind of weird.
I'm going to send it to you. You're gonna much yourself.
I want verification that picture was taken this year.
I don't know if Skip's cameras put timestamps on. Maybe they do, but you're going to doubt Skip Dickstein?
To me, it was taken a different year, and you're just trying to pull a fast one.
Well, when it comes to different years, there is a prominent photographer that seems to utilize previously published material. The I'll send you this. You're going to love. I'm going to put this up. It's gorgeous, just gorgeous. Three horses out in a field, and there's geese, and there's everything. It's a composition masterpiece.
Go ahead, make me feel even worse.
Well, you can feel good. I'll give you something to feel good about. A 3-year-old won the Jockey Club Gold Cup.
Yes. Not only that, but they finished 3-year-olds finished 1-2.
That's right.
So, listen, I mean, it's not always exactly a premier Jockey Club Gold Cup. You know, we don't know how good these horses are yet because they're just coming into their own. But, yeah, you know, again, I don't like to. I'm certainly not going to second guess or judge any of the decisions made by Shug. Yeah, but he had been quoted in the Naira notes last week about code of honor, and the quote was that he was doing good, and we'll point him for the Clark or the Cigar Mile. And I said, okay, that was a non-quote quote. I mean, what does that mean? And so I went on the archives to listen to him on your show, and I was kind of surprised to hear that he basically alluded to the fact that sounds like he's afraid of the competition. He's afraid of Improbable, and I'm saying, well, I don't get it. I mean, he said that there was Improbable and there was some other nice horses, and I mean, going to Breeders' Cup Classic, I mean, you can't be afraid of one horse. It's not like Improbable is like going up against Arrogate or California Chrome or American Pharoah. You know, he said he's looking for an easier spot. And I said, I don't know. I mean, he knows more about the horse than I do, but if he was looking for an easier spot, he should have run in the Jockey Club Gold Cup instead of going against Complexity in a four-horse field going a mile. Because, I mean, I believe he would have just blown right by those 2 3-year-olds. I mean, they're nice up-and-coming horses, but, you know, they're second tier right now going into the race. They certainly were second tier 3-year-olds. And, you know, talking about a horse who's already won the Travers at 1.25 and won the Jockey Club Gold Cup last year, beating Vino Rosso. And he hasn't been 1.25 this year. He's run 4 races, and 3 of them have been around 1 turn. So I don't know what's going on with that horse. Because like I said in the last show, I thought his race in the Kelso would set him up absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
I would have loved him in the Breeders' Cup Classic. And I just don't understand why he's not running in it. I just don't get it. But, I mean, Shug obviously knows the horse. But if the only reason he's not going is that he's afraid of Improbable, I don't get that either. So, I don't know, we'll see if they change. Listen, last year after the Jockey Club Gold Cup, Shirk said that Court of Honor was not going to run in the Breeders' Cup Classic and then changed his mind, which turned out to be his original decision was the right one because the horse had a long campaign. And to ship to California, you know, where Shirk hasn't had the best of success, you know, in the Breeders' Cup out there. I thought it was the wrong decision to change his mind, what might have been an owner's decision. But this year, maybe he'll change his mind for the right way. Maybe he'll change his mind and go in the race and win it. Because I obviously think a lot higher of Code of Honor than Shug does. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm just kind of perplexed by it all. That's all.
Well, it's not necessarily a higher opinion as opposed to a perception as to, you know, aptitude and what might be a better, you know, what might be better on the timing as it stands. I mean, it sure feels like the one turn, you know, the cigar mile. It was great that I thought it was great that you. I realized that an hour later that he had called it the Naira mile.
I know, which was fun. I heard that. Well, that's good. I like old school, old fashioned.
Yeah.
Think of it the old way. They haven't run the Naira mile in like what, 15 years or so.
At least.
I mean, if the timing's not right, I don't know. I mean, I just think the horse is crying out for a mile and a quarter. You know, running in the Met Mile. I thought he ran a tremendous race in the Met Mile. I thought he ran a tremendous. He had no shot to win the Kelso in a four-horse field. Complexity just absolutely controlled the race, and he's not going to beat him in a mile. I mean, they actually flew home in that race. They were going 23, 23-2, and, you know, there's no way in the world he was going to win a race like that. And the only other race, the only two-turn race he had was the Whitney, where they went and won 14 and... I mean, in 49 and 113 and change. There was absolutely no way he was going to win that race off of those kind of fractions. But, you know, a race like this with a ton of speed and the Breeders' Cup going a mile and a quarter. Again, I'm looking at it, you know, on paper and from a handicapper's point of view. I obviously can't look at it from a shark's point of view, being with the horse every day. But just looking at it from my standpoint, I don't get it. I mean, if Shook said he was going to the Breeders' Cup Classic, would you like him in that race?
I suppose knowing that there's going to be, you know, an honest pace scenario. Maybe, I suppose. I don't know if I'd like him ahead of Improbable, but...
Well, again, you got one horse to beat. You know, Alan Jerkins always said, never be afraid of one horse.
Well, there's not one horse to beat, but there's...
No, I'm not saying that, but I mean...
A favorite that...
mentioned the one horse.
Well, the one horse that has the same running style.
Well, I don't know. Improbable, I think, is going to be a lot closer to the pace than Code of Honor would be.
Not based on that start the other day.
What's that?
Not based on that start the other day.
Well, that was a small field, and he had three speed horses in there, and he had no choice but to sit back and forth and make that one race, that one move. I mean, you know, because he was not going to outrun those other horses. I mean, the race was set up perfectly. He had a tremendous race. Don't get me wrong. He's really good right now. He's very good right now. But when you have a short field like that, and the other three horses in the race are all speed horses, you have no choice but to sit back and make that one run and basically just swoop by everybody with that one big move. But, yeah, I mean, he's the horse to beat. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, you're going to have a lot of pace in there. You know, obviously Authentic's going to be pace and Maximum Security is going to be pace. And, you know, there'll be a lot of horses close to the pace in there. But, you know, you look at the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and that came up really with not much, you know, when you have Tacitus on the lead going in 49-3 and 113-3, and Tacitus, I mean, he's become like the Los Angeles Chargers. I mean, no matter how he runs, I mean, he always finds a way to lose. I mean, no matter what, he can run anyway. He can come off the base, he can come from far back, he can be on a lead. He always manages to find a way to lose. So, you know, he's become kind of a bewilderment. But, you know, again, look at Jack Club Gold Cup. You had a small field. You have two up-and-coming three-year-olds run 1-2, and they ran well. I mean, they came home in 23-3 and 24-2. But, you know, we'll see. I think Happy Shaver will still be a pretty big price in the Breeders' Cup, in the Classic. And the thing is, you know, Tis the Lord is the horse everybody's forgotten about. But I tell you, though, if you look at the Thoroughgraph numbers, there's a very good chance, and I'm a very good chance, that Bob Baffert could run 1-2-3 in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Is what I found amazing about the about the Thurgraf numbers in the Preakness. And, you know, a Swiss skydiver had run a career best in that race. She ran a negative 1.5, you know, which is good, you know, for Philly. But the list that she beat, Authentic, ran a negative 3.25. I didn't see him lose that much ground in there. He was always running like a path outside of her, but, boy, negative 3.25, he had never come close to that. So I don't know, maybe this horse is just really, really getting good right now. But I was really surprised to see such a vast difference between the winner and the second-place horse, where the second-place horse gets almost 2 full points faster than the winner. So, I mean, you know, if you go by that, I mean, he ran an absolutely spectacular race. You know, and you look at Improbable, he was coming off of 3 straight negative 2.5s, and before that, he ran a negative 3.5. So, you know, he's consistently fast right now. And Maximum Security, you know, he's sort of heading the other direction, but he did start off the year in Saudi Arabia by running a negative 3.25, and he hasn't come close to that yet. But I mean, it is, you know, it is possible. And Bob Baffert could be very, very prominent in this race.
Yeah,
if you look
no
at Tisla's numbers, Tisla's really never run a really fast number. As fast as he's ever run in his life is a negative 3/4. So we'll say he should be fresh, and he should be ready to go.
Now, the horses that...
We'll see what happens. Tom Sataro is still intriguing because he's consistently fast. Tailed off a little bit in his last start, but he's had a freshening, and he could be interesting here. But right now, it looks like Baffert is in really, really good shape in that race.
Yeah, and I'm anxious as the things firm up. There's a couple of intriguing types, including By My Standards and Global Campaign, that when it comes time to, you know, figure out who, you know, who comes and gets involved, you know, to kind of boost things in. I'll be hard pressed already to be against Improbable, who I've been a huge fan of from day one. So,
well, like I said, you know, last time, you know, when I was on, I went through his female family. That Derby Dan family just brings back all old memories for me. But speaking of By My Standards, you know, I pulled his Thurgraf numbers too, and I was actually surprised how slow his numbers are. I mean, I don't know if that's any indication of anything, but I mean, they're like nowhere near these other horses, which kind of surprised me because he's so consistent. He runs well every time, but you just have to wonder. But listen, Improbable was always a good horse. You know, he just ran into some hard luck as a 3-year-old, but he's just getting so good right now. He really is. And what he did to Maximum Security just never, ever ran his race last time out. He just never looked comfortable at all. So I don't know if he's tailing off or the race just didn't set up for him well, running between horses and trying to come from off the pace. But I think we'll see some different tactics. But like you said, the thing about Improbable is that you can do anything with him. You can put him on a lead. You can sit right off the pace. You can sit a few lengths. Now that you know he's got that big burst of speed when you need it, you know, he's going to be very, very tough.
Steve, talk about, let's get a couple of other thoughts in, the 2-year-old event. Who can you equate Jackie's Warrior with at this point, you know, off the sequence now of 3 straight super impressive stake wins? I mean, that was as impressive as Champagne as you'll want to see.
Would it be a cardinal sin to, like, say Seattle Slough or something like that? I mean, I'm just looking for a 2-year-old that just absolutely dominates, that you just can't outrun him. He just, the way he's been running right now, I actually thought at the head of the stretch, I thought Reinvestment Risk had him measured. I mean, it looked like he was, I said, all right, well, reinvestment Risk is right up there. He's right up alongside of him. And, you know, he's a horse that's going to come from off the pace. He's a horse that's bred for stamina. And then he straightened out, and Jackie's Warrior just pulled away from him. And he came home solid, you know, 24, 24-3, ran a, you know, good, 135 and two for a mile. And you got to remember, he was 8 3/4 lengths back to the third horse. It was Midnight Bourbon, who I thought, you know, looked really good coming into this race. I thought he was coming off an excellent performance, and they just absolutely pulled away from him. Now, it's just a question of how far he wants to go. You know, he obviously doesn't have the pedigree to be a classic horse, but he's very talented, and we'll just see how long he can go, how far he can stretch out that speed. But right now, I mean, there's just nobody that's going to – I don't see anybody outrunning him. I mean, just look at his times of all of his races. Every one of them is, like, brilliant times. So we'll see. Now, listen, we don't know how far the McLean's Musics want to run. I mean, you know, he didn't never had a chance. He was like a raised and native type. You know, he made a couple of starts in his life, ran fast, and disappeared. So, again, we'll see. We don't know how far his horses want to run. Right now, it doesn't look like this horse is your typical mile and a quarter horse, but racing has changed dramatically. We see horses winning the Derby wire to wire now, or right, pressing the pace the whole way. We never, ever used to see that. You know, I still have it in my mindset. You know, if I see a horse who's dependent on the leader, throw him out for the Derby. That's why I keep losing every year, because they keep winning every year. I mean, the only horse that I really loved all year that had that race like that was Always Dreaming. But, like I said, year after year, I mean, you just don't see horses coming from far back anymore in a Derby, which is actually kind of sad in a way, because you always want to look for that horse that comes from off the pace with a big move. And now the speed horses are separating themselves from the other horses, turning for home. You realize, you picked a come-from-behind horse. You look at this year, you know, I had so many come-from-behind horses that looked, to me, live horses for the trifecta. And they turned for home, and I said, where are they? I mean, they're nowhere. And it seems to happen every single year. You get a fluke performance. You know, I don't know if it was a fluke performance, but, you know, you look at Mr. Big News. You know, it looked like he was going to win the Derby, and he couldn't keep up with the top two, and then you couldn't find him in the Preakness. So, who knows? I mean, it's a strange year for three-year-olds. I think you got two top-tier horses right now with Authentic and Tis the Law, and then there's a gap to the rest of them. We'll see how good Happy Saver is. You know, he's only had the four starts. Mr. Guide looks like he's not going to point for the classic. I guess they're going to go shorter with him, but I thought he'd be a good classic horse. He's certainly bred for a mile and a quarter.
I was hoping that I don't know. Let me go to my list. Hold on. Let me see if I. I had it up, and I've erased it.
Swiss Skydiver, I'm sure it's going to go into distaff. So
yeah, why would you even? I mean, it would be insane to. The principles the principles are pretty much locked in. Just looking at this.
Well, I mean, you know, listen, you got Improbable is going to be the definitive choice in there. And you got Tis the Law, and you got Authentic and Maximum Security and Tom's the Tot and Global Campaign and Happy Saver and By My Standards. I guess Tacitus will go. And you got the other two California horses who really aren't look that good, Mid-Court and Higher Power, and I think that's basically it for now. So, I mean, you know, it looks like, you know, could be an interesting bet, race betting-wise. If you love Improbable, there's a lot of horses to choose from to bet them underneath.
Steve, I'll switch up on you a little bit. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Dale from yesterday, but right after Mr. Freeze won that Fayette on Saturday, I sent Dale a text. I said, run him in the sprint. And Dale, unprovoked yesterday, Dale brought it up, and he said, you know, somebody sent me a text saying to run him in the sprint, and I thought at first that's crazy, and then the more I'm thinking about it, you said it's not so crazy. And what do you think? I mean, wouldn't this be the right year to run a horse like Mr. Freeze? To me, what does a dirt mile get you? You run in the Breeders' Cup Sprint and win that, it's a significant stripe.
Well, Well, I think, I don't think we have a real, we don't really have a super horse anymore. I don't know how good that York Pond is.
It's fast.
People forget, by the way, a good trivia question is that name the Breeders' Cup sprint winner who had won the Suburban Handicap at a mile and a quarter.
A Precisionist?
No. Let's put it this way. For the early part of the show, we were talking about his trainer a lot. It was a Phipps horse, Dancing Spree.
Oh, gosh.
Dancing Spree. And I said, what the heck is he doing in the sprint? Source is one. He won the Suburban.
Wow, good job. Good
job.
Didn't
look like he wanted to sprint at all. And there was like so much speed in that race. And he came absolutely flying at the end. He got through on the rail and came flying at the end of that race to win, to get up. And I think he won by like 3/4 of a length. But it was like sort of like a Breeders' Cup phenomenon that nobody really remembers or mentions at all. But I've never seen a horse come into that. You're right about Precisionist. Precisionist, he came back in the sprint, but he was coming off a long layoff. They had freshened him up and sharpened him up, and that was a terrific Breeders' Cup sprint. But Precisionist had really shown in his career that he could go long or short. He was just a very fast horse who could carry his speed a mile and a quarter. Dancing Spree was a stone closer. I mean, he was a come from behind horse. Who won the mile and a quarter Suburban? So to run him in a sprint, I mean, it's absolutely genius of Shug. That was a year. That was a year too. He was loaded. He had Easy Goer going that year, and he had a lot of good horses going that year. I think that might have been the same year he had Mining. Mining was a different year. I forgot who else he had. I think he had a few other horses in the Breeders' Cup that year, but. I mean, that was a stroke of genius, running Dancing Spree in a sprint. It just looked like, wow, what the heck is this all about?
So maybe
it might be right. I mean, it could be set up for him. Look, I always look at it this way, by the way. Well, especially 7, 6, you don't know, unless you have some really, really tremendous sprinters. You know, like if you have, like, super horse sprinters, you know, like I had last year, and the horse, they say, well, I don't know, no way I can beat him at 6 furlongs, but... If you have a race where you look at it and there's a lot of speed in the race, a lot of times sprint races are won by the class horses. You look at a race like the Malibu, which is 7 furlongs. How many times do you see horses, distance horses winning that race? I mean, Buck Pass won it and Damascus won it. And I remember when Ferdinand ran against Snow Chief. I said, what is Ferdinand? Ferdinand's no way in the world he can beat Snow Chief going 7 furlongs. He blew right by him. So sometimes you just don't know. I remember Carl Nasker ran unbridled in a sprint race. He wound up going 121 and change and won off easily. So a lot of times it's the class horse that wins these races.
Mm-hmm. What about Gulch?
Gulch was basically a miler who could stretch the speed out, definitely, obviously, to a mile and eighth, like in the Wood Memorial or so. But that was a great train job and a great ride by Cordero. But that was a race that was set up beautifully for him, and he was able to come from off the pace and win. Talking about a 2-time Met Mile winner.
And I'm just looking. His name jumps off the page when you look at the list of sprint winners. That was successful going a route of ground, whether it's one turn miles or two turns. And even when he got beaten, things like the Whitney. I mean, he was competitive, going a mile and eighth. But I tell you, it has been a long time, Steve, since there's been this kind of a gambit. In terms of a authentic, route going type that's tried to win the sprint. I'm just looking through
I'm just wondering if there's. I'm just wondering if there are other horses like that this year.
Well,
I think this sprint would be a good race for Mr. Freeze. I mean, he's got some natural speed.
I just, you know, you look at the list of sprint winners versus what the you know, not that dirt mile winners haven't been, you know, nice enough, but it's just not, you know, and he needs, as I said to Dale, as a son of To Honor and Serve, he kind of needs, you know, a big grade one stripe. Not that the dirt mile, you know, there's been dirt mile success stories. I mean, Golden Sands and Midshipman, right? Midshipman would fit that. But boy, you win a Breeders' Cup sprint, and given, you know, his other graded stake wins, you know, going routes of ground, you really have built a strong case when you go, you know, stallion hunting.
So I don't want to lower the reputation of the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile, but I can't remember who wins most of them.
It's funny that way. You're right. It's funny.
It's such a mishmash of races. I mean, some years it's one turn, some years it's two turns, some years it's not even a mile. I mean, it's just, you know, you run it at a mile, and if you run it around two turns, like at Santa Anita, you start looking at these races and say, you know, you're at Keeneland and saying, You know, you draw an outside post, and it's just not a true race to me. The Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile would be a prestigious race if every year it was run around one turn.
Yes, so that was the Downs
and
that
Belmont
was the hope.
Park every year.
And Belmont, yeah,
it would be a good race. But to me, a 1 mile race around two turns is no different than a mile and a 16th race. And mile and 16th is a distance where you're not even going to find any grade one races at a mile and 16th. It's sort of a cheaper distance, mile and 70 yards, mile and 16th. There's no difference. You don't really find, you know, I know Golden Sense, you know, did it, and he was a good miler, but he just dominated that field. But I mean, if you want to look for a true miler, you really can't look at the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. I mean, I'm not saying there haven't been good horses that have won it. But if you look at the two-turn Breeders' Cup Dirt Miles, I don't even remember who wins most of them. You remember who wins the Breeders' Cup Sprint a lot more.
Yeah. Well, and by the way,
like I said, dead last year. You know, if you had a horse like Mattoli going this year, I said, I don't know if I would. I don't know if I can be able to beat him like that. But you know, anytime you get a wide open race and. You just don't know. Yofan looks like a really good horse, but he's a 3-year-old, so we really don't know yet how good he is. He hasn't run that much. I think he's only run like 4 times. So, you know, you take a shot.
Well,
we've seen Breeders' Cup sprints one from way off the pace. You know, I think Amazombie, right? He came from off the pace. Midnight Lou came from way off the pace to win it. Yeah, we've seen it. We've seen a lot of years.
Well, here's a little note since we're on this topic, here's a great little quiz. Today, there's a maiden race for 3 and ups at Keeneland. There's 2-year-olds go in the fourth, but there's 3 and ups going 6.5 in the fifth to start the pick 5 at Keeneland today. And Steve Asmussen has a first... the horse that is making a first-time start in the barn, named Extreme Force, that happens to be a half to last year's Dirt Mile winner.
Oh, really?
Yes. Do we remember last year's Dirt Mile winner?
I don't remember Dirt Mile winners at all.
Well, and he won it like an absolute champ, and we actually liked him last year. Spun to Run.
What was it?
Spun to Run.
Oh. Okay.
Spun to Run.
Well, again, if you go back and start looking at the... If you go back and start looking at the Breeders' Cup mile winners, but the thing is, Spun to Run. I mean, when you look at that race, you know, it was sort of a strange race. He just went out there and stole it, really, right, if I remember correctly.
Pretty much, yeah. He just ran them off their feet and just, you know, as Jay says, went to the front and improved his position. He just...
Yeah, exactly.
He killed them. And then, you know, but then he came back and he ran very well. If you remember, he came back in the cigar and ran a good second in the cigar to back it up before, you know, having to be retired. You know, he was second to Maximum Security in the cigar. So I don't know I forget where he signed on, where he's standing.
But
anyway.
I remember those early days when they first started the dirt mile, where I think it took 3 years before they actually ran it on the dirt at a mile.
Right.
If you remember the first year, they ran it at Monmouth, so they couldn't run it at a mile.
It was a mile and 40.
Mile and 70.
Mile 70, I think. Yeah,
they ran a mile 70 in a Corinthian one. And then I think the next 2 years it was run on synthetic.
That's correct. Yeah.
You know, and so I said, well, let's, you know, when are we going to finally get one? Yeah, and the thing is, nobody remembers who won those. I think what? I think remember Albertus Maximus won one of those.
Yes, he did. He won the second one.
Yeah, he had that Ramsey horse. What the heck was his name?
Furthest Land.
Furthest Land. Right. And then I'm trying to think who else. I think they ran it at Churchill. What was the name of that horse?
The Hollendorfer.
I think it was.
Dakota Phone is right.
Yeah, the thing is, nobody's going to remember these horses.
Yep. Caleb's Posse.
The best horse that won the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile was Liam's Map. I mean, he was probably the best one.
Well, and he was criticized.
City of Light was good, you know, when he won.
He was criticized heavily for that decision when they took the path of least resistance.
The thing is, I wanted to see him in there because I said, with him out of there and Beholder out of the race, I said, American Pharoah is an absolute lock in here. There's absolutely nobody to run with him. So everybody wanted every horse that could have challenged American Pharoah for the lead dropped out of the race.
That's right.
Somebody scratched right at the last minute. Another speed horse. I forgot who it was. So another speed horse scratched, got hurt or something right at the last minute. And he came out. It would have been a long shot, but he was still a speed horse.
You're right. Now that you say that.
Yeah, it might have been a California horse.
I remember that.
Maybe McGann or something on the lead. I can't remember who it was. I can't remember his name.
Interesting.
But that just left American Pharoah completely alone on the lead without being challenged. So I'm saying, you know, why the heck did Liam Smapton run this race? Listen, he won the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile, but I don't know. I mean, he's just not going to... Listen, I can remember a horse like that because of what he had done earlier, and he was a brilliant horse. You know, I get Battle of Midway, I think, was another Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile winner.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely. Tamar Kouz.
Tamar Kouz, yeah. He's turning, and he looks like he might be a good sire. But, I mean, I don't know if a lot of people are going to remember Tamar Kouz, what Tapas are. You know, Tapazar is what I'm thinking of. Who's a good sire?
You know what? I cited Midshipman. He didn't even win. He was third in 2009. I gave him credit for winning one, but he was third.
Yeah, that was a terrible field. That was the Furthest Land race, right?
Yes, it was, with Reddy's Echo in between.
Probably,
I tell you, obviously.
Came from way out of it. I think that one. Caleb's Posse, didn't he come from way out of it?
Yes, he did. He beat Shackelford and Trace Barachas. I'm just looking at this. Gunrunner was second to Tamar Kouz. How funny is that? I've forgotten that.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that, too. That's wild.
And Accelerate was third.
That's very interesting. I mean, the two horses that, you know, you think of as distance horses.
Well, last year, you know, it's funny. Last year was a great story. There was Spun to Run and Omaha Beach, who long term probably.
We got a terrible ride, by the way.
Well, and it started badly.
What's he doing back there? I mean, he had no shot to. And the thing is, it was a type of race. You looked at the when you handicapped the race, you said somebody's going to steal this race. This guy out there, there was no speed. For a Breeders' Cup dirt mile, there was no speed in there. And, you know, spun the run, got out there, and just outran everybody.
You know who was third? That was a fun story. Was that that crazy Korean horse, that Blue Chipper?
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah. He ran a good race, actually.
He ran a huge race. He was terrific. He ran a absolutely terrific race to hit the board. We probably spent more time in the dirt mile here than we will Breeders' Cup week.
I don't even know how we got started talking about this. Going in the sprint instead of the dirt mile.
Well, I distracted everybody because, you know, extreme, to get back for a second to this race today at Keeneland. Fifth race, 12-1, Extreme Force, is by Constitution out of the nice Yawkey Way, who we remember in New York. And, you know, it's been away since January. This is one of the Cortland Farm, one of the Don Adam horses that Mark Hennig had, and this one's now with Asmussen. He sent them around to a couple different people, but when he and Mark split up. And I think there's reason to think, you know, this is a very funny field. There's some firsters in here. Catalano's got a Gary Mary West that's been away for a year and a half. I thought Larry Jones has got a sibling of a horse you loved that you and I argued about. You were the only person who kept believing in Super Steed. Super Steed.
Super Steed. God, that's a name blast from the past.
He's got an Empire Maker brother who's been gelded already. It was a very modest purchase, but had a nice enough debut at Churchill in September in the race that produced Guided Missile. Fastly is in here, too. The Brett Calhoun, Tom Durant, Justin Phillip colt. But I thought Totally Jimbo, 6-1 on the outside. That's who I put on top. Just an interesting race. Chad's got a Three Chimneys Peter Brandt, $500,000 Into Mischief, who's been gelded, as it happens, was gelded back in February. Mystic Knight. There's all kinds of things going on here.
You're on top of all these races. I mean, I heard you talking to Shug. I mean, you know which of his horses are running 2 weeks from now.
Well, I got it all. I kind of planned out the week, and this card is too much fun today. The Sycamore later, which is always a good race. It's a nice card at Keeneland today. Two allowances, two maiden specials, but then it ends with a 20-non-2. Oh, and
there's a really good 2-year-old maiden race at Belmont tomorrow that could be interesting.
Going
a mile and a 16th. I don't know if you saw that race.
I have not. I did not look at Friday yet.
Fletcher's got some in there, and Chad Brown, some really, really well-bred horses. You know, if you get a chance, check out the eighth at Belmont tomorrow. Mile and a 16th, 2-year-old maiden race.
Pulling it up now. Nice, Chad. There you go. Peter Vegso with a Blame colt.
I mean,
Fletcher Fipke.
It'll be interesting. I mean, actually, one of them was the one that Shook Source. That 10-10.
Yeah. We brought he. This horse.
He's a frosted.
That's right.
Frosted colt. And Pletcher's got a first timer by Frosted. That's supposed to be a really good horse. And
well, he's also got
got
a tap it
horse, for Peter Brandt named Savoy by Honor Code.
We saw that horse at Saratoga.
His last start.
I saw that race. That was at the end of Saratoga. That's also the race that produced Speaker's Corner.
Yeah, he was way too far back, but he closed. He closed a lot of grounds at the end.
Yes, he did.
He could be interesting.
I was there that day.
You see these horses going a mile on the 16th. It makes it makes it very interesting.
That was closing day. Yeah, the horse you didn't mention. What about the Bridlewood Don Alberto Homebred Firster for Todd? That's out of Baffled. Constitutional Law.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, first time starter. He's the one who's. He looks like he's been working pretty well. It's hard to tell with Todd, because right now his horse is training over the training track, so you really can't tell how fast they go. But he certainly got the pedigree, being by Tappet.
Steve, got to.
A lot of good pedigrees. It's an interesting race to watch. We'll see if anybody comes out of there.
I'm glad you fleshed that out. I appreciate it. I've got to get Tony in here.
By the way, Steve, I want to tell you about it. I'm very offended.
That?
I'm very offended, by the way, that in your scheduled guests for today, you didn't mention me.
What do you mean?
You mentioned Frank Gangst, and you mentioned Tony, and you mentioned Dick Powell, and you did not mention me.
It's Thursday.
Okay, maybe I'm not going on today.
Everybody
you
knew.
I know why. Because I'm the proverbial man who needs no introduction.
But I'm bumped. There you go. No, it's Thursday, so they knew. You know what I did? I was tying specific topics to the guest lineup. And I didn't have a specific topic for you as the meandering frequently produces.
I forgive you.
No, I feel terrible now. Steve, I appreciate it. And Steve, folks, secretariat.com. And you can also interact, of course, everywhere Steve Haskett is on the internet.
If you want to interact, just call me at home.
Exactly. Thanks, Steve.
Take care.
Steve Haskett, everybody. Tony Black is standing by. We got to get, I don't know how many times, how many weeks in a row, Tony, we can talk about these whip rules, but certainly Mike Smith stepping up and taking a stand and drawing attention to the topic regarding California and to the CHRB and to state officials. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, I read Mike Smith's letter, and he hit on every important point there was to hit on. It's a safety issue. It's an integrity issue when it comes to where horses finish. And it also becomes an issue with the type of crop that is used. So he was hitting on all important parts of these whip rules, which, believe me, they're a detriment to the business and to a jockey and horse safety. But he also kind of put people on notice. Who's going to be liable if you plant this seed of negative thought in a jockey's mind where he allows these whip rules to overtake his instinct and what he knows to do right on a horse's back? And in not doing so, not reacting instinctually on a horse's back because you planted the seed of thought about a whip roll in his brain. Who's going to be liable if it results in injury to that jockey? Who's going to be liable? Is it going to be the racing organization? Is it going to be the authorities, the commission? There's a liability that somebody's going to have to be on notice. And this letter that he wrote kind of places them on notice. It seems to me that in many cases, liability lawsuits get more done to put people on notice that they might be subjected to one than it does all the screaming and yelling does about a rule like this. The only sad part of it is somebody has to get hurt before that the people who implement these rules are being liable for an injury to a rider and a horse. It's ridiculous. The bottom line is you just need people up there monitoring the race, monitoring a jockey's performance and use of the whip that know something about riding a horse. You can't put a blanket rule out there that fits every circumstance that a horse subjects a rider to in his performing on that as a jockey on that horse's back. I can cite an incident, and it was many years ago, my first incident of going through the inside fence at Pimlico, and I had a whip in my right hand, and you're usually closer to the inside fence than you are to the outside fence because, you know, you're running on the inside of a racetrack, not on the outside. So there was this horse, and I'll never forget his name, Lest, L-E-S-T. It was in the 70s. He decided going into the 3/8 pole, he was going to take a shortcut and go through the 3/8 pole. I didn't have a chance to get my stick over into my left hand because you carry it in your right hand. And he went right through the inside fence at Pimlico, and I knocked all my bottom teeth out, and I landed in the cement gutter that used to be at the 3/8 pole, maybe still there. And I'll never forget the bruising and scrapes and cuts I had all over my body. And it was that day I said, geez, if this horse was trying to bolt, I would have had enough time, you know, to get the stick over, or it was in my right hand, and do one thing. And you know what you do to a horse that is uncontrollable with the bit and the reins? A lot of times what will save you, and it will save me from going through the outside fence, was your stick is cocked. You cock it. You wave it at them. And then if that does, they don't respond to waving it at them, you reach and you smack them in the soft muzzle of their nose, because there is a sensitive area, and the horse will stop trying to get out, even if the bit isn't controlling him, because you've created a situation that they don't like, a stinging to the left, to the right side of their nose. And that you need to do with a cock stick. When you're telling a jockey he can't cock his stick, and the only reason you're saying, well, he can snap him on the shoulder as much as he wants, because you can't tell when a stick is uncocked if he's snapping him on the shoulder, and they feel that that's not of any... that's nothing that is going to be inhumane to a horse by snapping him on his shoulder with an uncocked stick. But you have to be able to cock your stick. How do you show a horse the stick, really, really show it to him with an uncocked stick? On top of that, when it comes to switching sticks, usually when you're switching to your left hand, your stick is cocked and you pull it right through. The one thing that they're all missing, these racing jurisdictions and the commission, is if you want to pass a rule that says you must use the gentle touch 360 that Ramon Dominguez has been experimenting with, and it is a good stick. It's out there.
Guys, are you? It's being widely used.
That's what you have to. You want to enforce that? Enforce that. It's being widely used. And make sure every racing jurisdiction uses it. But don't come up with this BS. You can't cock it. Don't come up, because I'll hit you with it, Steve. And my soft touch 360 will be cocked. And you'll say, man, that makes a lot of noise, but it didn't hurt, Tone. Because I really like this stick. But this is all BS, and his letter was right to the point, and I don't know if it's going to serve any purpose. And you know the other thing we discussed? Jockeys basically are stereotyped as little dummies that don't know anything except putting a leg on each side of the horse. And they've yet to come to a jockey and say, be a part of this discussion with the commission. Be a part of it. But they don't do that, because we're stereotyped as little dummies that the only thing we know how to do is put boots, white pants on, and funny-looking colors. And it's kind of a shame, because, you know what, even in the old days, there was jockeys that did have some intelligence and weren't just wearing those funny-looking little collars and boots and pants, and had a brain in their head that did work. And there are even more of them today that have a brain in their head and did work. I remember an old jock named Nick Jemis, and he was very instrumental in running the Jocks Guild and being a part of the formation of the Jocks Guild. And the guy was a financial wizard. He was a financial wizard. He not only invested the Jocks Guild money into the stock market in different areas and ran it up to millions of dollars, he himself, because he... I was a neighbor, and he was also, Nick Jemis was the Jocks Guild managing director for many years. He even taught me a little bit about financing. But there was other guys that did well as a managing director of the Jocks Guild, like John Giovanni, you know, mm-hmm. Jockey that had a brain in his head. He was well-spoken. He knew a lot about business and dealing with management. But, you know, it's a shame that jockeys aren't given a little more credit for having a brain in their head. But I guess in some years past, they earned that stereotype of not being the smartest people out there. Now, I know probably what affected me in a negative way was probably landing on my head too many times when I did come on the horses. But now, I just wish that they would involve jockeys in these types of discussions concerning whip use and rules that concern your performance on a horse's back.
Well, and the question, not the question, but the very fair critique for those that, you know, are dedicated to changing the, you know, the way it looks regarding the stick. Is there a practical re-education that can be accomplished with the riders? I mean, because one of the things that Mike was saying in that in his letter is that, you know, the jockeys are accustomed to and are trained, you know, to use the stick in you know, with certain physical maneuvers. How difficult will it be to relearn this? I mean, because I got to tell you, Tony, it's not going to go back the other direction. There's going to be more restrictions, and there's a whole community out there that doesn't think there's any reason for riders to carry a stick, period. I mean, there's that whole school of thought. To me, it's a slippery slope because you're acquiescing to criticism from people who don't really know, and we've tried to educate, but it's obvious you're not going to accomplish that. You're not going to educate the public that thinks the horses are being abused. No matter, I mean, if you're using a Nerf ball, they're going to think it's abuse.
Well, yeah, and you're right about one thing. It's never going to go back to what it was. I understand that. And re-education sometimes takes a little bit of time. And some of the best education that a jockey learns is from fines and suspensions and ill teaching. Look, this isn't acceptable. That horse was dead last. You hit him 10 times from the quarter pole to the wire. He was not picking it up. He got no response from the stick. What were you doing? You know, and there's a warning, $1,000 fine, suspension, 3 to 5, 7 days, whatever. That'll teach him. You know, you got to understand, in the 30s, the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, there was a re-education of what to do as a rider out on that racetrack. You know, there was times that riders used to get so close and hook each other with the elbow and put the stick into the chest of the horse next to them, you know, and actually the pressure of the stick. I mean, there was actually jockeys that twisted the stick into the tail of the horse in front of them, and you were to the side. And you know what? I had old guy teach me all this stuff. Chris Rogers, where you put the stick in the tail of the horse that's to the side of you, in front of you, and put a lot of pressure against his tail and let him pull you.
Tony, let me pull you up. Let me pull you up for 1 minute because we've got Mike Smith.
Mike Smith.
Mike, thanks for joining us. Tony is sounding off. He loved what you wrote.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm just trying to get it done where it's done properly and where everyone can use it nice and safe and you know, it's good for us and for horses and everybody else, you know.
Mike, I think one of the things that you communicated, and certainly Johnny Velasquez as well, as you know, you guys are co-chairs, and Johnny's frustration is that these rules are being passed without any discussion with the riders, or if there is discussion, it's lip service that they're allowing you to say something, and then they just pass whatever the hell they want.
Yeah, I mean we've been allowed to discuss it with them, but it doesn't seem to do anything. We just kind of say what we believe and what we think and what we really know, and then it just kind of doesn't quite go our way at all. I know there needs to be a change, but we want to certainly meet in the middle at some point. We're just completely one-sided, which, you know, we don't agree with. especially if you're ridden a horse, you can talk to Tony about it. It's to use it, especially here in California, the way they got it, where it's, you know, it's the number is six, but only underhanded. When you get a big old stud colt lugging in pretty good, and you're trying to use it properly to keep the horse straight and keep everyone safe, it's very, very difficult. You can't hardly do it. If you can really even do it at all, so you know it can be dangerous at times. So you can turn it up and use it properly. And like I said, we all know that as in everything, there's going to be some change, and we're all for that. And the number is six, but you could use it underhanded as needed, and then when it's time to turn it up, maybe the number is six, and you can use it properly to go ahead and ask the horse to finish, to keep them straight, to be able to guide them, and you know, to get the best out of them, and be able, right, like I said, to use it properly and safe. And nowadays, you know, we use these foam cushion whips, cushion crops that are, man, they're brilliant. They're so kind. They're very equine friendly. They don't hurt them in any way. If you see them, especially the good ones we have nowadays, they're amazing. And as long as you have to use one of those and be able to use it properly, it's safe for everybody.
And they make a lot of noise, don't they, Mike? They make a lot of noise.
It just kind of makes a noise. Yeah, but
the impact is so light against their hide, it shows it doesn't even affect them. I love the Gentle 360.
Yeah, they're so good. They're amazing right now. They're great. And so as long as you apply where you have to use one of those and just be able to use it properly and I think we have no problem, but for some reason they want to make us completely change the style of the way you're supposed to use it, and it's not working.
I totally agree that, you know, the type of stick that's being used should be focused on and not how to carry it, how to cock it, and change a whole rider's point of view of how to use it.
You have to count the number when you're in the middle of,
right,
you know, trying
but
to win beer something and having to count at the same time. It just don't make sense.
And Mike, when it comes to using the stick, like you said, there are times you have to cock that stick up in order to show it properly to the horse so that the horse feel enough, you know, see enough of it. And then sometimes, you know, I went through an inside fence once, and I wished I had it in my left hand and could have tapped him in the nose just so I wouldn't have gone through the inside fence. But the same situation can occur going through the outside fence where the bit no longer steers the horse. The bit and rein no longer steers the horse for a multitude of reasons. There could be a cut, a bruise in the horse's mouth, and the more you pull on the left rein, the more they get out. And your last resort is instinctually thinking is reach, cock the stick, tap him on the nose. When you plant seeds of negative thought about using a stick in a jockey's mind, he might get away from thinking instinctually what is the right thing to do, and it could result in an accident. And my whole thing is, who's going to be liable for a jock getting hurt because you put these negative thoughts of use of stick in his mind, and he goes through the outside fence and gets
prohibiting them to use it properly? You know, again, you know, it could, you know, you well know
your letter was beautiful.
It's going to come up, and then what's going to happen?
Yeah, your letter was beautiful. It was right to the point, and you touched on every area that needed to be touched on. My hat's off to you. And you know what? As much as your dad and me were friends, I'm sure he's looking down and saying, "That's my boy. That's my boy, Mike."
thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. You made my day, buddy. You made my day. Thank you, guys. I hate to get off. I love to talk, but I'm in the middle of a training session here.
Go ahead. No, this was
right,
perfect,
guys.
Mike. Okay, thanks.
God bless, and I'll talk to y'all soon.
I love it. Mike Smith, everybody. And for those that are curious, because some people, Tony, are saying, wow, Mike Smith and Tony Black over 100 years worth of riding experience, and the total number of wins between Tony Black and Mike Smith as of today, 10,804 between the two of you.
Well, we've been around there a few times. I bet you there's about 60,000, 70,000 times we've been around that oval, and probably hundreds of thousands of horses we've been on in the morning. So
Listen, Tony, look, this is amazing, actually. you, this is really quite something. You have had 33,964 mounts. Mike Smith, 33,707.
So 67,000 mounts.
67,671. But you both have had essentially, you know, 33,000, almost exactly 200 mounts apart, 250. And you've got 5,211 wins. Mike's got 5,593 wins. Your careers are really, in terms of experience, they're almost identical.
God bless him. I'll tell you what, I remember when he first started, and like I said, I was real good friends with his dad, saw him every day, had a lot of conversations, and we were both so proud of Mike when he went to California and fit right in with the jockey colony, but we weren't surprised, because Mike has been a world-class rider for a long time, and he's been someone that I have total respect for, and I just hope that these organizations that try to pass rules when it comes to riders' performances start to get and sincere, not BS communication, but sincere communication with Mike and people like him, because it'll benefit them in the long run, and it'll benefit the sport. And right now we have to, of course, make sure that the betting public is accommodated. But we can't do that by putting these rules out there that just BS the and are just put out there to schmooze the public. We have to put rules out there that really are effective, they really fit circumstances, and we need people monitoring the sport that really know what they're looking at. They just didn't wear suit and ties and shiny shoes every day. They sat on horses' back, some of them, at least somebody. And if we have to form another ruling body with a person that works along with the stewards that monitors riders' performance on a horse's back, well, let's do that. You know, have another ruling body or have someone out there that can assist the stewards in a way. Even if he's not a steward, he's not a fourth steward, he's an associate steward that is used in consultation. You know, let's do something, but don't put these blanket rules out there, because this sport has so many variables. Blanket rules do not fit every circumstance in any way in this sport of horse racing.
Tony Black, everybody. And Mike Smith, there you go. I'm trying to think over the years. Seth Merrow is going to join us next. Over the years, Tony, I'm trying to think of who else we've paired you up with. I've put you on with other riders a bunch of times. Nick, obviously, Santa Gata, Rich Migliori a few times.
Yeah.
Now Mike Smith. Who else have you been on with?
Gee, you know what? I know we've been on a few times with different riders.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, I can't think of it. But you got some world-class riders that you put on there, and I was glad they didn't hang up when they heard that I was one with them.
I'm going to put up these numbers side by side, too, because it's scary how similar the statistics are between the two of you guys. And let's see, Mike started in what? In 82. So he's got about,
right.
He's got about 10 years less, than you do in terms
but,
of,
you know what statistic will be very different, purse money earned.
Well, all right. I wasn't going to get into that. I wasn't going to give that number, but, he's got about five, it looks like about four times, but still, listen, you've earned $63 million, and of course Mike, you know, with all the Breeders' Cup the opportunities and the international, those crazy purse opportunities, $330 million. But
well, you know what he didn't do that I did? I bet he didn't ride a race for a $2,000 pot at Marlboro Racetrack.
I don't know. He might have in his early days, though, right? In New Mexico and some of those. I'm sure there some of the bush, and some of those kinds of places in the countryside, those little roadside tracks.
Yeah. I can never forget riding the Marlboro Racetrack at first. I think there was a $2,000 minimum person. $2,500 was about average what you ran for. $2,500 person. Every once in a while, they'd have a big purse, $10,000 or $15,000. Yeah, I won a Governor's Gold Cup at Marlboro's in the dead heat, and it was a $15,000 person. That was a big payday that day. And it was in a dead heat, too, with Tony Agnello.
I
name
love
from
it.
The past.
I love
but,
it.
Mike, what a world-class rider he is, and so proud of him. And like I said, I know George, his dad, and me were good friends, and I'm sure George is prouder than proud to have been the dad of this rider, Mike Smith. He's a unique individual, and he's an outstanding athlete, and has tremendous integrity and credibility and respect in the sport of horse racing.
Very much, and I'm just putting these numbers together side by side. It's uncanny how close the numbers parallel each other. Tony Black, Tony, this was great, and I appreciate, you know, we keep coming back to this topic, but it's in the headlines, and it's too important not to discuss. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely, too important not to discuss. Keep up the good work. It's always a pleasure, Steve, and. I really appreciate all you do for the sport. Thank you, Steve.
Not at
Take
all.
Care.
Tony Black, everybody, the one and only. And we'll stay here. We got less than 15 minutes, today's been stacked up again. We just took the one break. Yesterday we ran out of racetrack, and we missed Seth Merrow. We're going to get him in right now. Here he is, Mr. Summer Casual. Good morning.
Matt Damon, you're Jimmy Kimmel. I'm the guest that stays in the green room. But I've said before, I'm just working on the computer. I'm listening. I was enjoying the show yesterday. I was listening earlier today. I'll bring up, you mentioned the breeding, but you didn't mention constitutional law in that 8th tomorrow at Belmont. That's a full 2 constitution. So,
that's true. Look at you, Mr. Nature Nurture.
I've handicapped for tomorrow's TV already, so I put that one on top. I'll take the 10-1.
Look at that. I'm very impressed with you. That is...
And also, I'll bring up, I was listening yesterday with Andy, and I was one of the people on the outside looking in on that kind of crazy DQ. Well, it wasn't a DQ. The non-starter at Keeneland the other day where the gate didn't open on time. And the upshot of your discussion, I guess, were kind of where you guys were, too. These, some of the DQ rules and rules like that, it's hard to know what the right answer is. But I wonder if they couldn't, I don't know who it would hurt necessarily, refund any wager that had that horse on top, but pay out the rest. Because I said I was on the outside looking in. I was in doing TV that day, and I called the cold exacta with a 7-1 shot on top and the Chad horse that ran second that eventually was declared the non-starter. So I was kind of a little bit disappointed with the result there. And as I say, and as you were both talking about yesterday, you and Andy, the horse ran so well and got up there for second, so the people who had exactas and triples kind of, like I say, you're on the outside looking in. I couldn't find the Kentucky rule, but I pulled up the New York rule, and the New York rule is if the stewards declare that, the horse had an unfair start, and it says specifically in the rules, if the horse doesn't win, they have to then declare it a non-starter. So their hands are kind of tied in that situation. But like I say, I wonder if the track could just say, we're refunding everything where the horse would use the win slot, but we'll pay out the rest of them. But maybe that has some unintended consequences I haven't thought about either.
And you bring up an excellent element to this, which is that there isn't necessarily if it was unfair. What determines if it was quote unquote unfair? And if it was an unfair advantage or an unfair disadvantage, and as Andy said, if the horse wins, would they have taken him down if he had won?
Well, the New York rule says that if the horse wins, he stays up.
There we go.
So,
but I'm saying, so yeah, the Kentucky wasn't. It's not delineated.
No, I didn't see the Kentucky rules. I tried to look up the.
That's
Kentucky
what I'm saying.
Rules.
I couldn't
find them. I don't know. But you have to. I mean, I get it. The gate opened late. If you watch the head-on shot, the gate definitely opens late. So the people who had the horse in the win spot have a perfectly legitimate argument there too. Like I say, the rules are tough. And then there was the other day in New York, there was the situation, and the stewards eventually did nothing. But as I was watching the replay in New York, there was a Mike Luzzi long shot that wound up running third.
Yeah, close. We talked about that.
Yeah. It's on Sunday, yeah.
Yeah.
And you could have made the Monday. Argument, I think he was so close that they could have switched it. Oh. But again, the winner didn't really deserve to be the winner. Who would have been the winner? The horse that ran second didn't
Correct.
Really deserve to get moved up into the win spot. So how do they rectify that? It's just they're tough, and you could change the rules, I suppose, to give a lot more discretion to stewards, but I think that would definitely have some unintended consequences. I don't know whether they'd even want that kind of power, but as I was looking at that the other day, I was thinking, how could they rectify this? I mean, to me, the perfect solution, they just won't do it. And again, it would give stewards an extra level of power. You say the winner was the clear winner, and maybe you do something with the jockey and then call a dead heat on second. Just declare it a dead heat, because the horse that eventually ran third probably could have been second. And the horse, so you get away with that. But again, they're perhaps unintended consequences to those kind of decisions as well. I'm always for the best decision that helps the most bettors. But and some players, I don't think, want that, because they figure half the time I'll lose, half the time I'll win, and the time I win, I'll get paid more.
Well, let's get everybody paid this afternoon. What are we looking at? You got a little Keeneland?
The fourth race today, I'll just toss out 5-1, always late's interesting. A second time starter goes into the barn of Bill Mott, but it's just simply to analyze the odds. And that one won its career debut. So I'm tilting for always late. I have an 11-4, 3-8 in the fourth. But again, that 11 in the second start. Started at Kentucky Downs, chasing one of those maiden special weights over there. And so I think the move over to Keeneland and move into the Bill Mott barn may be good for analyze late. We'll see if we can get the 5-1. So what do we have? About 5 minutes, if I'm looking? Three minutes? Something like that?
I've got some of the late action.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to switch over to the pick four. You mentioned, I'll toss out the fifth race because you mentioned Extreme Force. I looked at that one, and yeah, there were a couple of nice siblings and then a couple maybe that weren't so much. So I left Extreme Force out. I went 1-7, 8-4 in that fifth. I thought it was a tough race, but I went to Chad Brown first. So I like Into Mischief to pay $500,000. Gaff Leone, as usual, is riding well at Keeneland, so at 1-7, 8-4 in that fifth. The Asmussen horse you mentioned does scare me. There's no question about it. Sixth race, again, the late pick four. I have 3-12, 4-1. I thought this race would have some pace for Dance Rhythms to close into. There are a few other horses in here that I think will show a little bit of early pace. And again, Dance Rhythms, I think, can kind of stalk and maybe be the first to pounce at the top of the stretch. So I'll go with that one on top. And then go out to the number 12 Originator, who again can maybe set up the pace and make a move late and pick up some pieces there. And then one of the horses that I think has some early speed, the Wesley Ward runner, Lady Worthington, in the third spot. So in the sixth, I have a 3-12, 4-1. Seventh race, allowance non-winners are one. Other types, 2-9, 1-10. Glory Road on top for Dallas Stewart. Again, Gaff Leone's riding well. He was on board the horse last time over at Churchill. It was a nice effort in similar non-winners of one competition. The numbers are going in the right direction. Lightly raced, and again, moving in the right direction. Might be primed for a good try today at 5-1. Don Bourbon in the second spot, up a couple of good tries at Ellis and Churchill most recently. Broke the maiden two back, got the experience at this level last time. Sometimes it'll take a start or two as you move to the next condition. And so this horse got that education last time. And then Spa City, the Dolphin and Brad Cox, and there obviously are some races that seem to indicate some talent. They got ambitious, tried the Tampa Bay Derby. Didn't run that well in there, has been off since. But again, I thought there was some flashes shown of talent. If Spasity comes back ready off the layup, could be a player in here as well. So the seventh had a 2-9-1-10. Sycamore, fun. You mentioned it earlier. Fun little midweek stakes race, stakes action. I have it 6-2-5-3. I put Aquaphobia on top. The United Nations two back was pretty good. Sword Dancer, you know, was okay. Channel Maker got out there and went all the way around. It was also that fluky day where, you know, the track had to it poured and then the sun came out and then poured. If you watch the replay of the race, you would be surprised that it was a soft track because by the time they ran, the sun was blaring. But it was a funny track. So the third last time was okay, but I'm looking more at the United Nations two back. Red Knight looks good off the past couple of starts, but I think Big Agenda, the five horse on the pick place, I'll toss that one in. I mean, why is this horse 10-1? Mike Maker, Tyler Gaffleon, coming off a couple of good optional wins, one of them over at Kentucky Downs. So Big Agenda is going to get on my ticket at a price in there. What were your thoughts on the Sycamore?
I'm all over the place, and I haven't built the tickets yet, so I may end up spreading widely because there is no shortage of candidates. I mean, the key here is the pace. I mean, how much, you know, who is it, and you know, where is it going to come from? Eons takes the blinkers off, so that is a consideration. Graham is so good, these first-time North America runners. Ziad is going to get plenty of attention. You know, Mott with Red Knight. I thought Postulation, even, from Matt's, has got some appeal. I'd love to see Leperu get aggressive. And you're looking at Big Agenda, you know, as a potential pace factor and a horse that might, you know, Gaffleon not bad at seizing control either. So I thought that the pace question mark is very murky here, and that throws it, you know, kind of into a, you know, into a little bit of a tizzy. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. What are you doing in the nightcap?
I have it 7-6-3. You're right. It's a tough way to end up the sequence. Major attraction on top for me. The race two back with the move to turf was very good. Yeah, you threw in a little bit of a dud and a starter allowance. That was clearly saltier last time than the group today. So I'll look for a rebound to that race two back again with Gaffleon on board for Catalano. So 7-6-3 for me.
Seth Merrow, everybody. Seth Merrow 2 on your Twitter and Capital OTB TV, Equidaily.com. And you know, at outstanding watering holes throughout Saratoga.
I'm taking a break during the pandemic.
I want to thank Seth and, of course, Tony Black and Mike Smith together again for the first time. They've been in the same gate a number of times. Steve Haskin, Frank Angst, Dick Powell, Hong Kong Jockey Club, HKJC Racing. This Thursday. Yeah, I'm going to finish writing up the Keeneland action. I'll put it up on the website. I hope we can get a few like yesterday. Yesterday was okay, even though we didn't connect on the multis. Had a couple of nice priced winners. Good luck today, everybody. Weekend preview tomorrow, including visits from Nick Luck, Joe Applebaum, Jay Privman, and more. Talk to you then.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the Races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.